Right. Okay, well, thanks very much for inviting me along. I guess it was Terry, Michael, and Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about, as the title says, yikes, the title doesn't say anything. Where's our gentleman that, oh, just press here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do something to.
Ah, okay. There we are. I hope that doesn't happen again. I'm going to talk about accounting for phylogenetic uncertainty in comparative studies, MCMC and MCMC approaches. Now, we come from a really wide variety of backgrounds, so I'm going to start off by talking about what comparative studies are just for a minute, and why phylogenetic uncertainty is important, an important problem in comparative studies, and then I'll get on to talking about how we can solve that problem. Now, comparative studies are very widely used in evolutionary biology to study hypotheses about evolution and adaptation. It must be one of the most enduring ways of studying hypotheses about evolution and adaptation, experimental approaches being another way, comparative studies being one. What comparative studies attempt to do is find relationships across groups of organisms, relationships between traits, and those relationships are thought in some way to reveal the course of evolution. So, for example, one might be interested in the relationship between molecular diversity and time across a group of organisms, and that might reveal something about the rate of molecular evolution. One might be interested in the relationship between a couple of traits, like the size of your brain and the size of your body, across a wide group of organisms, and that might tell you something about how one or the other of those traits responds to evolution in the other one, or how both of them respond to selective pressures from their environment. So, comparative studies are very widely used, can be applied to a range of traits, morphological traits, behavioral traits, genetic traits, just about anything, you name it, ecological traits, and so on. Now, because in biology, it's normally the case that the lineages or the organisms that we're studying have evolved according to the hierarchical branching pattern that we think of as a genealogy or a phylogeny, it's important to take into account the phylogenetic relationships among the group of organisms that you're studying. And the easiest way of seeing that is that if we have a group of organisms that are evolving according to a hierarchical pattern, a genealogy or a phylogeny, groups of closely related organisms may have their traits by virtue of common ancestry, and we'd like to untangle that from species that have acquired their traits or their trait values as a result of adaptation to their environment. And so the phylogeny helps us to sort of untangle the shared effects of common ancestry from environmental adaptation. Very, very important to take into account phylogenetic relationships when doing comparative studies. Now, if one were interested in reconstructing the ancestral states of a group of organisms, imagine one had a group, one wanted to know what the ancestral state for that group was, it's obvious that you have to know the phylogenetic relationships. How else could you reconstruct ancestral states? Now, what arises in comparative studies when we use phylogenies is frequently that the phylogeny itself is treated as if it's known without error. So we construct a phylogeny by some means, and then we treat it as if it's known without error. We treat it as a fixed entity, perfectly known. But of course, that's seldom going to be true. And phylogenetic uncertainty has somehow to be brought into the equation for finding out the comparative relationship, for testing the hypothesis about adaptation or evolution. The reason being that different phylogenies may give different answers to the comparative question. And so we need a way of accounting for the inherent uncertainty in phylogenies. All right, now that's all by way of background. That's all a little bit abstract. Let's just have a look at a couple of examples. Imagine that one were interested in the Ascomycota fungi. Some people are, mycologists are. Here is a phylogeny of 54 Ascomycota fungi. Now, these, I believe, are fungi that we come into contact with all of the time. There's nothing very surreal about them or rare about them. But what I give this example for is that on this particular phylogeny, one can write down for the tips of the species, so here are the 54 species, whether or not they form a lichen. So that's the symbiotic relationship between a fungus and an algae. And we can write down for each one of these tips whether or not it's lichen-forming. And so these open ones, the non-filled ones, are not lichen-forming. And the green ones are lichen-forming. And then the interesting thing, if we have a pointer, I can just sort of point up here. Do we have a pointer? Okay. It's like a pole vault stick. Interesting thing is that up here there are some non-lichen-forming forms, and there's a few others in here somewhere, that appear to be secondarily non-lichen-forming. So most of us, I think of as not forming lichen as the sort of ancestral state. That's what existed in the past. And then somehow fungi came to have these symbiotic relationships with algae. They became lichen-forming. But then what's interesting about this phylogeny is that there's a number of forms that have secondarily lost the habit of forming a lichen. Now, this is interesting because it turns out that these ones that have secondarily lost the ability to form lichens seem to be ones that disproportionately have economic and medical value or importance to humans. So one. Yeah, and I'll come to that right now. So now, the statements I just made about this being ancestral, then lichenization being evolved, and then these things secondarily losing lichen, is based upon this phylogenetic tree. And where does this phylogenetic tree come from? Well, a colleague of mine and I sequenced, well, he did the sequencing, not me, sequenced about 1,000 nucleotides of ribosomal RNA, and we used those nucleotides to reconstruct this phylogenetic tree using maximum likelihood procedures. Now, I'll come on to what all those things mean in a few minutes. The point is, even though we believe this is a pretty good tree, that other people might come up with different trees, there may be a range of possible trees that are almost equally likely, and so we have to allow that there's uncertainty in that phylogeny. And in making these statements about when things evolved on this tree and when things were secondarily lost, I am presuming that this is the correct tree. So any uncertainty in those tree might change the conclusions that I reach about the rate at which lichenization happens and the rate at which it's lost. Okay, I don't want to spend any more time on that just now. I'll come back to this example to illustrate MCMC approaches in just a moment. Let me just give you another example of a typical sort of comparative study. This is not my work. This is some work that was published in the mid-1990s about reconstructing the ancestral state of ribonuclease proteins. And here the point is that a group of investigators had the idea that if you study this ribonuclease protein, which is a protein that exists in the gut of grazing animals, so here's a whole lot of grazing animals, this ribonuclease breaks down ribose sugars. That's a very important enzyme for grazing animals. And it's just an interesting evolutionary notion that there's a particular amino acid in this ribonuclease protein, and the amino acid site 38, that has been very labile in evolution. So that if you come up with a phylogeny of these species and you attempt to reconstruct the ancestral state of this amino acid, G being glycine, D aspartic acid, given the what's known about the contemporary species, then you conclude that there have been maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, perhaps 5 independent times in evolution that glycine has replaced aspartic acid at that amino acid position. Now, I don't wish to make anything of this example in particular, except to say this is the kind of comparative study that evolutionary biologists like to do. This one, using genetic data or protein data, is telling us something about the way proteins evolve, and if one knew something about the selective regimes that these organisms had been subjected to, one might be able to say something about how proteins evolve, how rapidly they evolve, and to what environmental regimes they respond. Here again, it's obvious that to make this statement about glycine replacing aspartic acid all these times, one has to have the phylogeny so that one can reconstruct ancestral states. But obviously, here again, the conclusions that one reaches about what those ancestral states were and when they existed depends very, very strongly on the phylogeny, which here is being treated, as in the previous example, as known perfectly and without error. All right. Well, those are a couple of examples of comparative studies. We could go on with other examples about correlated trait evolution and so on. I happen to choose two that involved reconstructing ancestral states. All right, phylogenetic uncertainty. Well, we've said that there's this problem that phylogenies are not known typically with certainty. And so we need to have some sort of response to that. How is it that we can somehow work phylogenetic uncertainty into comparative studies when what we want to estimate is things like ancestral states, rates of evolution, and so on? Well, just to raise the topic of phylogenetic uncertainty, with just three species, you can see that there's one possible unrooted tree, but there are already three possible rooted trees, and the problem really gets out of hand very, very rapidly after that, because if we plot the number of possible phylogenetic trees as a function of the number of species, you can see that by the time we get to anything with an interesting number of species, here with six species we've already got 945 possible rooted trees, and with just 10 species, 34 million possible rooted trees. And then as we get up to 50, on the order of the fungi example I gave you, I think we've already got more possible phylogenetic trees than there are particles in the universe. But some of you people would be very good at knowing what that number is. Okay, so it's a very, very, very large number of possible phylogenetic trees. Now, the reason this is important is that it means that we have to have a systematic approach for dealing with phylogenetic uncertainty. Because what might we do confronted with phylogenetic uncertainty? Well, one response is typically to say, well, I'm going to search for the best possible phylogenetic tree according to some criterion. And the trouble with searching for the best possible phylogenetic tree according to some criterion is that there's no particular reason to believe that the best tree under some criterion of what constitutes a good tree is the true phylogenetic tree. Now, searching for the best tree has been the sort of sine qua non of all of phylogeny reconstruction, and well, it should have been for the last 30 or 40 years, but in fact, there's no particular reason to believe that the best tree is the true tree. Now, what's another response then to phylogenetic uncertainty? One might say, well, what I'll do is get a whole lot of trees and somehow find a consensus of those trees and use that as a way of dealing with phylogenetic uncertainty. But of course, we know the consensus tree is not the true tree because it's a consensus of a whole lot of other trees, and only one of those can be the true tree. Well, similarly, we can't just go out and say, well, I'm going to come up with 10 or 15 or 100 trees and I'll find the comparative relationship that I'm interested in each one of those trees, because you can see that given that the universe of possible trees is so large, we need to have some way of justifying any particular sample that we come up with. So a haphazard sample just won't do. All right, so to solve these problems of phylogenetic uncertainty, enter Markov chain Monte Carlo techniques. Now, many of you are probably familiar with Markov chain Monte Carlo. I won't go into it at a technical level, but we can talk about it at any level we wish as we go. But here, just to introduce it, we've got this problem of phylogenetic uncertainty. We need some way of dealing with the vast number of possible phylogenetic trees, the vast universe of possible phylogenetic trees. Markov chain Monte Carlo methods afford one possible way of doing that, because what Markov chain Monte Carlo methods allow us to do is to generate a long chain of phylogenetic trees that we think is a Markov chain. And if we allow that Markov chain to go to its equilibrium, then the successive phylogenetic trees that come off the end of the chain should give us a random sample of the universe of possible phylogenetic trees. So once the Markov chain has reached its equilibrium value, phylogenies will come off the end of the chain in proportion to their probability of occurrence in the universe of possible trees.
Can you explain a little bit, what is the Markov chain?
Yeah, I'll go on. I thought this crowd would be very, very familiar with Markov chains. So Markov chains are take the following form. We can think of a Markov chain as a chain of events in which we can move from one part of the sample space of possible outcomes to another according to a transition probability model. So we have some model that tells us how we move from one state to another in the possible universe. And it's a property of Markov chains that if we allow those chains to run long enough, they reach a steady state where they start to visit states of the universe in proportion to their probabilities.
A state is a sequence.
In this particular case, the states are the possible phylogenies. So the universe specifies all possible states, which are all possible phylogenetic trees, and what we need is some sort of generator that tells us how we move among states in the universe.
By phylogeny, you mean a tree. So each tree is a tree.
Yeah.
But why should one tree and another tree be related in a Markov chain? You're not thinking of a real...
Yeah, thinking of a real Markov chain in the sense that what we have is, we know there's a universe of possible trees, and what we can say is that those trees are related in the following way, that if I have a tree that has this topology and I have a tree that has that topology, there'll be some way I can change this tree to go to that tree. So there'll be some change of the topology of this tree that will take me to there. So what the Markov chain has to do is to have a generator of states in the possible universe that allows us to jump among all possible outcomes.
Right, but the main property of the Markov chain is that the probability goes from state A to state B is independent of its previous history.
Yeah, yeah, that'll be true here as well.
So it's a one state, there's no memory of the...
Yeah, that's right, that'll be true here as well. But what we're going to do is we're going to start out with a phylogenetic tree, and then we're going to change it in some way. We're going to pick up a branch and move it somewhere else. And then we're going to pick up a branch in that new one and move it somewhere else. And then I'll get onto this in a moment. We'll use the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm to sort among those trees, the result being that we'll have the classic sort of no-memory properties of the Markov chain. Yeah, the tree proposal approach. How do we come up with new trees? We'll talk about that in just a minute. Yeah.
So is the length of the tree a length of the chain a free parameter?
Yes, free in the sense that we can allow it to go as long as we want.
Okay.
Yeah.
We
yeah. Yeah. Michael.
So the transition probability sort of local.
Pardon me.
The transition probability from one state to another state, one tree to another tree, it was only local.
That'll be one of the issues we'll want to discuss, because the application of MCMC methods to phylogenies is really very new, and the tree proposal mechanisms, how we transform a tree to go from one tree to another, those are really at the moment just being made up and seeing how well they work.
And what's Monte Carlo about
it? Oh, it's Monte Carlo, I suppose, just in the sense that we allow it to go for a long, long time. It's not Monte Carlo in the sense of a simulation, in that... In some sense, it's deterministic, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a way of specifying the ensemble of trees that you want to get beforehand, or will it just depend on your transition?
No, there isn't. The reason that MCMC is so useful for this problem is that you don't know what the universe looks like beforehand. So you need to have an unbiased way of actually sampling from that universe without being able to specify its density beforehand.
I do know the likelihood. The point is, you're sampling with probabilities proportional to the likelihood of those trees. So the likelihood is likely energy, not its likely Boltzmann factor. You know you want an equilibrium sample. That's the equivalent of saying you want to sample all possible trees with probability.
So that's building into your transition matrix of the Markov chain.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get on to that in just a moment. But these are the key points. These are the key points about MCMC. I mean, and at the moment, a lot of these things like the tree proposal mechanism, which I've talked about here, and the acceptance mechanisms are all just being sort of tuned by eye, as it were. I mean, there isn't any really good way to do it other than to sort of dream up ways of proposing new trees and see how well they work.
No matter what you do, you'll never explore it. You'll only explore some region of it. So in a way, your MCMC method is as biased as any other because it depends on your starting point. And I presume that you always start with something plausible.
Random. Random. Yep. Random starting points, do it 10, 15, 20, 100 times, who knows how many. But the idea is, if you start from random starting points and you always end in the same place, that's consistent with going to the right place. And it's no proof that you have, but consistent with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shall we go on? We'll continue to take up these points, because these are all the key points, and I don't pretend to have the answers to them. I don't think anybody does yet.
You're going to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit more about it. Yeah. So we start out with some random phylogenetic tree, and we have a tree proposal mechanism that proposes new trees that are some number of jumps away from the starting tree. And then we have some acceptance mechanism that tells us whether to go to that state and stay there or to remain in the same state. And I'll get on to that. Once we've got that working and we generate a long chain, if we think it's converged, then we can take a random sample off the end of the chain. Like David's saying, this might be the Monte Carlo side of it, in the sense that we can let the chain go as long as we wish to, and we can sample off of the end of it. And then, if everything has worked, we should have a true random sample of this unknown universe of phylogenetic trees, where we've randomly sampled them according to their probability of occurrence in that universe. And then what we can do is, in effect, integrate the phylogeny right out of the equation, because remember, what we're interested in is some event or evolutionary process, some ancestral state, some correlation between a pair of traits, some rate of evolution. That's what we're interested in estimating. We can estimate that in every single topology, and in effect what we're doing is integrating over the space of possible topologies, thereby removing that from the equation, so that our conclusions are no longer conditional upon any one phylogenetic tree. David?
I was going to ask, I'm not sure about the random sampling from the converged chain, and if you're randomly sampling, you're going to get chains that are correlated due to the...
Oh, pardon, yeah. That's just bad English. I didn't mean that. We'll sample from the converged chain, and that would give us a random sample from the universe. Sorry, yeah, we're not randomly sampling. Yes, very good. Just sampling from the converged chain. You know, maybe every 10th one, every 100th one, every 1,000th one. And that should give us a random sample of the universe.
Yeah. Any subsequent tree has been obtained by some mutating process of an earlier tree.
Yeah.
How does one assure oneself that that process is random, so that the tree you get is not random?
Let's talk about that. I'll just come on to that in just one second. Let's just talk about the tree acceptance mechanism, and then we'll take that point up. These are all precisely the key points.
The way average all the, so suppose you get through the stationarity,
yep.
You always find a cloud around some center, or do you get multiple?
Yeah, so far in all the ones I've done, been pretty lucky in finding a nice looking cloud, a nice looking density cloud. I think it's highly likely that there will be instances in which there are going to be shapes all over the place.
That's sort of some way of in this very large universe that we don't know how to visualize, you have some way of collapsing into some. How do you know if one cloud?
Well, one of the things you can do is all you can do. If you have a sample of trees, all you can do is have a look at their topologies and see if broadly you have a whole lot of trees that have the same topology, whether you have radically different topologies with similar probabilities under the...
Is this by eye, or is there some...
So far, I just do it by eye, yeah. But that's because I'm not a great computer programmer. Yeah. Was Mike Charleston here, or somebody... Yeah.
I tried to give an introductory talk.
Okay. Yeah.
They've obviously all forgotten.
Well, now the key idea is that we normally with a Markov chain we have some generator, which I like to think of as, we can call it kappa, we can call it Q, whatever, and that generator is telling us what the transition probabilities are among states. Now, we don't know what that generator is with a universe that's vast and something like phylogenetic trees. We just don't know. So what we have to do is come up with a mechanism that we think will give us a sample of trees, which in retrospect might be able to tell us what that generator was. We don't actually want to know what the generator was, but we want a sample of trees that would have arisen had we known that generator. So what we're going to do is try to sample the universe in a way that is in effect the universe we would have sampled had we been able to generate that universe from a Markov chain going forward in time. And the way we do that is we start with a tree and alter it in some way. We apply some criterion to it to say how good or bad is that tree. And the criterion that we typically apply is something called the likelihood. And I don't know if we're familiar with likelihood widely in this audience, but I'll come on to what the likelihood is. Basically, the probability of observing the data that we have on that topology, given the model of evolution that we use. And then we decide, using the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, whether once we have jumped from one state to another, whether to accept that new tree or whether to reject it and stay in the same state. So we have a tree acceptance mechanism, the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, which says accept the new tree with probability 1 if the likelihood of the new tree is greater than the likelihood of the old tree, or, now this is a simplification, and I'll come on to why it's a simplification in a moment, accept the new tree with probability proportional to just the ratio of the two likelihoods. So if the new tree is a better tree, always jump to it. If the new tree we've proposed is a worse tree under our criterion, accept it with probability roughly proportional to the ratio of the two. So if it's 90% as good, accept that new tree with probability 0.9. If the ratio of the two is 0.2, accept that new tree with a probability 0.2. Now, the idea with the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, then, is that we will tend to visit regions of the universe in proportion to their probability of occurrence under our model of evolution. So if all of this works, if we have an unbiased tree proposal mechanism, and the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm is working for us, we'll tend to jump around the universe, staying in locations, visiting locations, roughly in proportion to their probability under our model of evolution. That's the key idea of MCMC. So it's a sort of magic in the sense that we don't know what the universe is. We wouldn't recognize it if we saw it, but we think we have an unbiased way of generating a sample of that universe.
It seems to me that the first of your choices immediately guarantees your bias, and your only hopes of getting away from local minima or maxima, depending, is that the ratios, although sometimes very small, are nevertheless sketchy, and those are the big jumps that you get you away from the local minimum. If the probability, if that ratio turns out to be 0.05, but nevertheless it happens to be your 100th tree, maybe at this time.
I think if the question is getting stuck at local maxima, I mean, you can imagine moving around this universe of phylogenetic trees, and if you're on some good point in that universe, it's unlikely that you're ever going to jump away from it. As a matter of fact, you will jump away from it if you wait long enough. You'll jump away from it in proportion to the probability under the model. So you should visit those other trees, even though they're worse, roughly in proportion to their probability in the universe. Now, you can get stuck, and this is a big problem with MCMC, and we'll get onto that with MC cubed, is one way of helping you get unstuck.
Is there much of a theory of MCMC in terms of convergence, in terms of ergodicity and things like that, or is
no.
It just mostly ad hoc?
Yeah, it's mostly ad hoc at the moment. There's very little at all. Number of iterations to convergence, how long you should run after you converge. And this is why I think it's an appropriate topic for this crowd, in that there's a lot of very important work to be done with MCMC still. And it's just in its infancy. You might even say it's fetal with respect to doing phylogenetic studies. I think there have now been two proper MCMC studies with comparative methods out of literally thousands and thousands and thousands of comparative studies over the years. Well, Paul, you're doing some, and I've done one. That's about it, I think. I literally think that's about it. And
there's several groups that are working on that.
Yeah, there's people working out there.
So you do have to make sure you don't ride in the same car ever.
Yes. No, literally, as far as published studies are concerned, I think it's one or two. Yeah, it's very, very new. Okay. So that's the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. Here it is actually in its full form, but I mean, really, this is perhaps too detailed for us to argue about here, because these things depend upon the particular problem. But in the previous slide, I just said that we accept according to the minimum of these two, so one if the tree is better, or this ratio if the tree is worse, and this is the ratio of the probability of the new tree to the old tree, but in the full Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, we weight that ratio by the prior ratio, so that if the new tree had a very, very high prior, we give it a little bit more weight because we think that's an important thing, but we seldom have any prior beliefs about the probability of a tree. We don't know very much about them, so these priors are usually equal, 1 upon n, basically. So this just goes out of the equation as a 1. And then we have the proposal ratio. And Walter, I suppose this is one of the things you were maybe implying, is that we have an implicit distribution from which we're drawing changes. And there's some probability of going that direction, there's some probability of going that direction. And so if the proposal ratio is asymmetrical, the probability of going, you know, to t from t prime, or going to t prime given t, if those two things are asymmetrical, then that ratio will be different from one. But mostly we draw these changes from symmetrical distributions, so this proposal ratio also is a one. And that's where you get this previous simplification that we accept with probability proportional to the likelihood of the two trees. And that's what I've used the F for here. That's just this. Okay, so what we have then is some method for wrenching about with trees, grabbing a branch of the tree and moving it somewhere else. And this is one of the things I'd like to talk about, because one can dream up a whole lot of ways of doing that. At the moment, I more or less do it just randomly. I pick a point at random and move it to another random point on the tree. And that's a highly disruptive thing to do, because most of the time you're getting very, very bad trees. But in another sense, it's an unbiased thing to do, in that you're going to some random point and going to some other random point, so you're not biasing the topologies that you come up with. But one can, there's infinite variations on that.
You're saying you're selecting random trees as your proposal?
Well, I start with a random tree, and then I propose a new tree by choosing a branch at random on the current tree and moving it to a random other point on that current tree. So that's my new tree.
And what is the point? Is that a node or an edge?
What I do is I select, I go and I find a branch, and then I find another branch to which I can move that one. Oh, sorry, and I take, yeah, so I'll go on. So I go along somewhere and I select a branch of a tree, and I take everything above it, say on the right or the left, and then I move that whole thing to some other point on the tree.
Now, is there anything that says that it means if you've got 10 to the 70th of possible trees, that the sampling of the trees that are available to you on a single move are a very small part of the total?
Well, if this is the universe, and I mean, these are all the same tree, but if this is the universe, and I randomly go to some place here, and I randomly move that to someplace else, I don't think I'm limiting myself to any particular part of the universe. I don't think I am. I mean, if I said I'm going to limit myself to choosing branches that just go to the tip and move those to some other branch that goes to the tip, then I think I might be biasing myself. But I think if I'm randomly doing that, I'm not. If I understand the question. As far as I know, there. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's three, this is a hard problem, there's three things. There's the topology, there's the branch lengths, and there's the parameters of the model of sequence evolution. So I talk about them as if they're one thing, but typically what one does is there's these three things: the topology, just the shape of the tree, the branch lengths, and the parameters of the model. And I'll show you what the models look like. And at any given iteration, one has to choose, what do I do now? Do I update the topology? Do I update the branches? Or do I update the parameters of the model of evolution? And there again, I don't think there's any particular good theory on how to do that. Typically what one does is just alternates between updating topologies, updating branch lengths, updating parameters.
When you change the model of evolution, that also changes
changes your likelihood, it changes your acceptance.
We're not so much changing the model of evolution as changing the values of the parameters in that model of evolution.
Does that also affect the likelihood?
Yes. Oh, yes, it does. But that...
It's not only the proposal of the tree proposal, it also changes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the point in the state, it's defined by the tree, the branches, and the parameters. You go from one point in that state to another.
Okay.
I'm not sure about which state are you doing. Is this Markov chain, or is it just the Monte Carlo?
Well, this is Markov in the sense that we have a way of moving from one of the states in the universe to another with some specified probability.
Which part of the you have many steps are doing?
Yeah.
Is this the last part, the metropolis part?
Yes, this is the metropolis part. Yeah. Well, again, this is another area where I think a lot of good work needs to be done. Typically, at convergence, one is getting acceptance rates of, between sort of 10, 15, and 40%.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 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 But I think. It obviously depends upon the tree proposal mechanism. This is one of the things we can talk about, because as one goes to convergence, one can alter one's tree proposal mechanism and say, well, now, if I think I'm getting towards convergence, I can start doing what, Walter, you were worried about, which is I can just start making local rearrangements rather than these catastrophic global rearrangements. And here again, my admission would be that this is completely seat of the pants at the moment. Just we try things and whatever works, we go with.
It's interesting, though, because your tendency to get clouds could either be that things are converging nicely or that you're getting trapped.
Yeah. 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 I think sometimes we do get trapped, and I'll show you sometimes we do. And I think most of the time now we're getting out of the traps, but I never really know, because one has to let these things run millions of iterations to be sure. Okay. Now, I said that this whole thing is based upon the likelihood of a set of data given a phylogeny. I just wanted to give a sort of primer of finding the likelihood of a phylogenetic tree. So here's the sort of thing. We had some aligned gene sequence data. Here's sheep, human, gorilla, and mink. And, this is the sort of thing we might be aiming at, although I'm not suggesting that's necessarily the correct phylogenetic tree. And what we have then is we start with the aligned sequence data, and then we need a model of sequence evolution that tells us how we think these data arose in nature. And the nice thing about gene sequence data is that they're finite, they've only got four states. And so we can write down a model that tells us how we think you can move from any other state at any site to any other one. And we typically then take these 16 possible transitions, and we represent them as a smaller number of parameters, just to make the maths a bit more tractable. But if we write down these instantaneous transition rates among these things in the typical sort of continuous time Markov model as a matrix Q, then the probability of observing any particular transition over time t is just e to the qt, just the standard result. And so we have a way then of finding the probability of any particular observed set of changes between any two points on the tree according to this simple probability model, p equals e to the qt. And then we just treat each of the branches of the phylogenetic tree as an independent point, and then the likelihood of observing these data on that phylogenetic tree given that model of evolution is just the product of these pt over all of the branches. Product of e to the qt. And then one can search among alternative topologies applying this to each one. And so the essence of the Markov chain Monte Carlo approach is that what we need is a way of searching among alternative topologies. How do we go from this one to this one? And here, we've moved mink over here and so on. And then we need a way of updating the parameters of the model of sequence evolution because we don't know these in advance. And we need a way of updating the branch lengths because these are not known either. So those are the three elements: the topology, the parameters of the transition matrix, these instantaneous transition rate parameters, and the branch lengths. So we choose a topology and we have to estimate the branch lengths and the transition rate parameters. Okay. Now, when we come up with some tree proposal mechanism and we use the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm, just to back up, to sort among those trees, we hope that if we choose some random point in this universe, it's probably going to be the case that it's a bad point, and then we hope that the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm will, we hope, rather quickly lead us into the good region of the universe. You know, there might be a number of good regions, but to make things simple, we hope there's a good region, and then we're going to just hop around among this sort of more restricted area, which is, we think, the area where the trees have the highest likelihood. And we should visit the trees in this area in proportion to their probability of occurrence, as given by their likelihood under the model. And the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm should assure that happens. Now, if all of this works, we have the nice property that we think we're getting a random sample of the universe according to the probability under the model of evolution. And it's also the case that we will end up with a sample of trees. That sample will include some very, very good fitting trees, that is, trees that have a very high score under our likelihood criterion. The sample will also include some trees that don't fit very well, and it should, if it's all nicely humped, it'll include a large number of trees that fit reasonably well, but perhaps not as good as the best ones. And so it's a rather nice result in the sense that we get away from this problem that we're only searching for the best possible phylogenetic tree, and that's a really key point of MCMC, is that we're not searching for the best tree, we're searching for a random sample of trees. And we get away from that problem that the best tree need not be the true tree, but rather what we hope to come up with is a sample of trees in proportion to their probability, so that we can truly say we have found the comparative relationship across a random sample. Yeah?
You mentioned that you think about
Oh, do they work, are you saying? Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I understand the question, I mean, it illuminates one of the things we're trying to avoid doing with MCMC. I could have some model for generating a tree. And Markov chain Monte Carlo would, I would hope, include that tree in its sample of trees that it found, but it would also include other trees as well. So maybe to restate your question, I mean, we could have a generator, a model that generated phylogenetic trees with likelihoods, and then I would hope that if I went back with some gene sequence data that I thought had arisen from your model, that I could recover that same universe. I haven't done such studies myself. That's the sort of thing that would need to be done.
Yeah.
I mean, the question of reproducibility is obviously an important one. What one does is repeats this sort of thing many, many times from random starting points. Start over here, you hope you end up in here. Start over here, you hope you end up in here. So what we do, I mean, again, don't know how many times to do it. We do it 5 or 10 times, and we see if we tend to converge to the same place. The convergence. Well, if you start with a whole lot of different random starting points, and if the chain converges to more or less exactly the same likelihood, that's a pretty good indicator you're in the same place. But then you can start looking at the actual topologies and see if they're the same topologies. Yeah, Mitch.
One thing I'm a little bit worried about, I can imagine that your model has some accuracy to it or whatever, that there are a relative few good trees, and as you go away from the good trees to less good trees and worse trees and things like that, the number of possible trees grows up extremely sharply. So there's so that it's possible to have the sampling very strongly influenced by the trees that are not very good. I can imagine that the likelihood estimate that you make might be reasonably good for the good trees, but may be rather bad estimate for the likelihood of the trees at the end of the distribution. So that if there are problems in estimating the likelihood of the trees at the end of the distribution, if you have them factor of 10 off from the likelihood population, there are so many of them, you could end up dominating your result, inappropriately dominating your result.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think that's a problem, but perhaps we should talk more about that. I mean, I think that when you say there might be a problem in estimating the likelihood. I think maybe this is what you're saying. I mean, I think the bigger problem is that you want to be sure you're giving your algorithm sufficient chance to visit those portions of the universe, so that you can accept or reject them.
The signal to noise on those far trees may be a lot larger.
Right.
And so by integrating, there are so many of those far trees that you end up bringing in a lot of noise into your data. Rather than signal.
Yeah, I don't know.
In practice, it's going to be anyway truncated.
Well, that's the question, is it truncated or not?
The
kind of probability.
Oh, sorry.
What was the previous question? Just to get an idea if somebody has done it, what if you take a model of evolution, or other words, you take your metrics Q, then you generate fake sequences with a tree which you know precisely, and with the types of branches which you know precisely.
Yeah.
And the model of evolution which you know precisely because you selected.
Yeah.
You generate the fake sequences.
Yeah.
Then you do your Monte Carlo algorithm and see if you recover this very model of evolution tree length.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the simpler case of doing everything you just said, generating some fake data, and then attempting to reconstruct the phylogenetic tree that you know is true because you made it up, the methods work pretty well.
But how deep was the tree where it worked pretty well? Because I can imagine it would work well for three or four species, but it may not work well for three.
Yeah, that's a good question. Wasn't David Hillis here last week talking about this? I think they get pretty big, but I don't honestly know. Maybe, yeah, I mean, not huge, to be sure. But I mean, I think it's probably been done for 30, 40 species, something like that. But they work pretty well, but they're not perfect by any means. Yeah. You should tell us that. Good.
Well, presumably depend on how much noise you have in a sequence. I mean, okay, so you have this precise evolution model, you can take and generate this thing. But so suppose you screw it up a little bit, will you still?
If you alter your chosen model of evolution, what you infer, I mean, the more you're deviating from what is the true model of evolution, the more that estimate, the more your estimate deviates from what you chose to begin with, you can run into some problems. But the topology typically is pretty stable. Maybe things that are related to the greatest ones, they have problems.
But it seems that the whole, I think that's sort of going against the whole philosophy of this. You know, I think the philosophy of this is the right answer is not the right answer.
That's right.
Basically, the question is, what can you derive based on the data? And something that gives you the right answer is not necessarily giving you something that's appropriate.
just to get a feeling, like in a typical output, how many different topologies would you have, say, around your peak of any significance in the sum?
I'll show you. I'll show you. Just I think we're very close to that very slide. Now that was a sort of primer. That was a sort of bluffer's guide to likelihood. The whole thing gets really ugly, and we can argue about this later on if you wish. I mean, I
can you ask me what's the computational cost of one step of your Monte Carlo, just calculating the likelihood if you have m species in one of them.
That's a very difficult question to answer. In seconds, you mean, or when you say computational cost? Oh gosh. Well, if you're really clever, not very much, in the sense that I've given this to you in an extremely simplified form. It turns out there are lots of little tricks one can do to save lots of computational time. So that, for example, if I have this tree and I alter it by altering that branch length, and that is one alteration of that tree, then about 95% of all the computations I've done on that tree I can keep. I don't have to do again.
If I just give you one tree that you haven't had in prior and you want to calculate,
yeah,
then you want to estimate.
Well, what we do is we calculate these things over all possible ancestral states at each node of the tree, and there's four possible states. So that goes up very, very rapidly as n to the fourth things you have to do. And you have to do that for each of the sites in the sequence. So it's a huge computational task, which is why there are these tricks for remembering what you don't have to do again.
But the whole calculation of the likelihood that goes as the size of the alphabet cubed. Sorry, it's the size of the alphabet cubed times the number of taxa.
That's very good. Little party aphorism to know.
It's multiplied by the length of the sequence times the number of sequences times the size of the alphabet cube.
But didn't you say so that the reconstruction of the consensus is like the number of sequences to the fourth power?
Yeah. The
fourth number of
sequences. Well, but we do a trick. We do a trick where we get it down. Yeah. Yeah. So we want that's just the ugly whole thing. But I think let's move on. We don't want to talk through this. And I'll forget what I wrote down anyway. But it is possible to write it down. We don't want to talk about this, do we? So terribly ugly. But we can make a copy and we can sit around a table and talk about it. Now what happens when you actually get to the point where you do this? Here is a Markov chain that we set off running on the fungi data. So we have 54 taxa, about 850 nucleotides for each taxon. We chose a random starting point in that very, very large universe. We calculate its likelihood, and then we start going on the Markov chain. So we propose a new tree or branch length or parameters of the model. We accept or reject that according to the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. And then we, because you typically start in such a very bad place, you climb really rather rapidly out of this very, very bad part of the universe. And you go up and up and up, and something happened to my computer there. This wasn't light speed, but... And then you come up to a point where you hope that you have converged, and that here the chain is then producing trees in proportion to their probability in the universe. You hope you've gone to the right place. And that's the sort of signature of convergence. You're not going up or down, but you're just, then if I blow up this area now, that you're just wandering around that probability space. So sometimes you wander up and you get better and better and better trees under the model. Other times you wander down and you get worse and worse and worse trees. I think Walter, this is one of the things that was worrying you, was that, you know, here we are on what would probably be a local adaptive peak, but can we get off it? Well, the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm will take us off it in proportion. Pardon? Well, this point, though, about should we stay here or not, is what the thing I want to emphasize is that we're not trying to find the best tree. We're trying to find a random sample of the trees in proportion to their probability under the model. So we have to get away from this thinking that that one right there, or whatever is the very best tree in the sample, is the one we want, because the very best tree is simply the most likely under our model of evolution. But the most likely tree under our model may not be the one that's most probable in nature, the most frequently occurring. Let me give you a good example of this, is that all of our models of evolution favor fewer changes. But to the extent that gene sequences are evolving with lots of parallel evolution, lots of convergent evolution, then what's called homoplasy will be common on trees, and actually trees with lower likelihoods may be closer to the truth. So that's one of the reasons I gave you that example of the artiodactyls, that there's a case where that protein maybe four or five times in 40 million years is evolving the same parallel thing at one site. And so a model that minimizes the change on that tree may not give you the right answer.
So with the model parameters sort of saturate on the same scale in your graph and see the likelihood?
Yeah. So if I were looking at the parameters, the instantaneous transition rates among the nucleotides, they tend to settle down in here as well. Yeah.
Maximum likelihood is actually far above that variation. And I don't know if you've calculated the maximum likelihood for this particular tree, but I mean, sometimes it does help to realize that, but I mean, it could be 14,300 or something, and just far off that graph.
We have always, now, I mean, David's saying the trouble with a case like this with 54 taxa, 1,000 nucleotides, finding the maximum likelihood tree is a huge task in itself. And when we've attempted to do that, you know, we do get trees, let's see, 14,745. Yeah, we do get trees right about in here. I've never had a case where the maximum likelihood tree is up here. Now, if we let the chain run long enough, we should visit that tree. If it's,
we should visit every tree.
As we should visit every tree.
Yeah.
If that were the case, that might be a diagnostic that we hadn't let the chain run long enough, or that the tail is really, really long.
I don't think it's necessarily true. The most likely tree may be extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely.
Mm.
It's a function of the number of parameters you're looking at.
Mm. Yeah.
If you know that the model generated a tree, then if you that thing itself, with that model or that topology used to generate the tree, would have been, well, it's close to the maximum likelihood.
Do we hope that that's the case?
Generating sequence according to this model.
Yeah.
And then that model itself, what would be a maximum likelihood tree? You use that as a reference to see how close it is.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, Walter.
This is a stupid question about some of the human problems. But you have generated now all these possible, what is the quality? You have sampled the random models. No one. I mean, how do you. You'd like to build a tree, how do you go from that random sample now to judge what is a reasonable tree, what is the...
Well, I think, this is an extremely good question, because what I'm saying is we have to have sort of shift in the way we think about this. All of us have spent, you know, all of our sort of adult lives that we've been worrying about phylogenies, trying to find the best tree given some criterion, parsimony, distance, likelihood. We hope that we're finding the true tree, you know, the one that God made. But we seldom have any information beyond the things we've measured, like the gene sequences. So we never really know that we're finding the true tree, but we're finding the best tree. Now, one of the points I'd like to make is that best trees under our criteria may not be true trees. And homoplasy, convergent evolution, parallel evolution are all things that nature may do, but our models don't like very much. Our models like to make trees in which change is uncommon. That typically leads to higher likelihoods. So we don't know that we've captured the true tree. So what we adopt is a statistical stance and to say, well, if we don't know what the true tree is, let's sample the universe statistically and average over all of those, in that way removing the phylogeny from the equation.
But if your final sample might change
Yeah.
So it's still like a problem. How do you understand? It's a good way of getting away from this notion of basically
a
quantum sum.
Yeah.
You know, arbitrary method. But in the end, how do you evaluate all these?
I can only give a partial answer to that, and it's not a completely satisfactory answer, but one of the ways, and I'll show you in just a second, one of the ways is now, remember, coming back to what I'm interested in, because I'm not interested here in finding the true topology, but I might be interested in asking, how often does a particular node on that tree arise? And so what I can do now is ask, does that node appear in 98% of the trees? And if it does, then I don't care what the true tree is. Okay. So that's going to get us out of that morass a little bit.
If you plot all these trees, sort of in a single plot, will it look like a random noise graph, or will there be branches that are shared by many of them? Because it's a way of sort of visualizing.
Yeah.
I guess about the presentation, how different these qualities are.
There are people who are really good at that kind of thing. I'm not very good at that kind of thing. I can tell you in this particular case, these trees are all really close to each other, in the sense that we'll see in just a minute. The tips are moving around a little bit, so species are jumping from here to here and so on. But we're not taking whole clades and shifting them around in this particular case. But I agree with you. In general, we need to know that, because it may be the case that in this noise, there are peaks here and here that are really very different topologies, but they have similar likelihoods under the model of evolution, and they represent completely different views of the way evolution has progressed. So that's important to be able to visualize the... I've sort of swept that under the rug, because I'm just not very good at such things. Yeah?
You mentioned that you take the likelihood of all trees to be one, so you call it
Yeah. No, well, if I understand the question, I think that might be the next slide. Are we meant to be breaking now? Somebody just walked out. Was that a message to me? Now, that's the frequency histogram of the trees that came off of that chain. So here's this bit here. And we say, okay, it's converged. Start sampling. And took about 10,000 trees on this particular example. I think we were taking every 100th tree that came off the chain, and that's what the histogram looks like. And David, your question about, do we get the ML one? I mean, David's point was that, you know, the ML tree might be way up here. The maximum likelihood may be way up here, but if it has an extremely low probability, then we're not going to get it even with 10,000 trees. But what's interesting here is that, I mean, Walt, this sort of gets back to your worry about getting stuck, is that here, this wandering around, is spanning about 50 log units. So, I mean, there's a big difference in the probability of these trees. So what do we have here? You know, 790 or so up here. It's about 50 log units these trees are sampling. So it's not trivial differences. Yeah. Up here. Yeah. Oops. There. Let's see. What did we do? Here we were. Oh, return to the same tree. Exactly. I don't know. I think it's probably extremely unlikely. Because remember, the branch links themselves vary continuously, but return to the same topology though.
Yes.
Oh, in this case, many times I think. Yeah.
How much of this width is due to the branch length variation? So if, for example, at one point you decide I fix the topology and allow branch length variation, would you get a similar?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here we're still varying the topology, branch lengths, and Q, all along here. The topologies here, I switched somewhere in here to a local proposal mechanism, so I'm only just kind of going like this at the tips. I'm not wrenching around, but I'm updating branch lengths and Q. Q, the transition rate matrix. Yeah.
So maybe you would expect the amplitude to break by order of one. If that is the yield measure of your criteria, Monte Carlo.
Okay, I'd take your word for it. I don't really understand the.
Actually, the reason is that the number of possible trees increases so sharply as you go away from the atomic rate that that's the thing that pushes the likelihood down much lower than this value one. In other words, if you had things evenly distributed in terms of the number of trees with likelihood values, then when you did the sampling, you would have on order of one variation.
So this parameter is going to tell us something about structural space.
Exactly.
Let's see, so we got that far. Here, in this particular case, we got a very nice looking histogram. And then, you see, we can take now these 10,000 trees. And now this is the tree I showed you at the outset. This is just one of the trees. I mean, this happens to be the consensus tree of the 10,000 in the previous slide. But more importantly, pardon me? Yeah. Just to have a picture to show you, it's just the consensus tree. Just to come up with a picture. I mean, I could have just chosen one of the topologies, I suppose. I could have chosen the best one, but we didn't really much care. We just put the consensus together. But the key thing then is that, and Walter, this is sort of getting to your point, is that there were particular nodes on this tree. For example, I mean, we want to be able to say right here that lichenization has been lost. And so we need to say that, if I remember our own codes here, we need to say that that node, let's see if we've got it here somewhere, is lichen forming. To be, yeah, and where is it? Here we are, yeah. And so here's the probability of a lichen symbiosis in the ancestral node. And here, for all of our trees, we calculated that probability in each of the 10,000 trees. And so we say here, no, the ancestral state there across, so for these three taxa, the ancestral state is not lichen forming. And it doesn't depend upon the particular topology. So we're reasonably certain that, independently of phylogenetic uncertainty, we can say that, indeed, that was not lichen-forming. And then if we go to 8, here's 8, so we go back one notch, 7 back to 8, we do the same thing, but here, independently again of the topology, we can say that it's a very high probability that it was lichen-forming. So we know that lichenization has been lost with a reasonable degree of certainty.
You look at the sequence and identify whether it's lichen forming or not, or do you use ability to form lichen as an extra residue? Or
no, it's a completely independent trait. So the mycologists say you don't form lichens, you do, you don't, you do. We're treating it as a binary state here.
That doesn't form part of the likelihood.
No, I kept that out of the likelihood model. Yeah.
So when you generate a likelihood model, and you have a particular tree form here,
yeah.
How do you generate the probability?
Yeah, okay. Well, the same continuous time Markov model that we use to analyze gene sequences, I also have such models for analyzing binary states. So I treat this binary state of lichenization or not as just
the parameters of lichenization, yeah. And delichenization change as well.
Yeah. Yeah, you can either put them into the Markov chain Monte Carlo. Here, I kept them out because I didn't want them in any way to influence my search of the tree space. But I simply fitted that model to every single one of the 10,000 trees, reconstructed the most probable ancestral state at these nodes, and got that. But then, Walter, coming back again to your point, and here are a couple of nodes you can see where we just don't have a clue what the ancestral state is. It's totally and utterly dependent upon the topology. So, forgotten which this is, 3. Yeah, so in here, we just don't have any idea what what the ancestral state is. And let's see, the average of these, I can't even read it. I think the average is quite low. It's like a 0.4 probability of, so I mean the density of this thing kind of goes like that. It's most of the density is down here. And here's another one. You can see most of the density is down here. But these make the point that phylogenetic uncertainty is a nasty thing. I mean, depending upon the phylogeny, you get a totally different answer to these ones. Here, you even get some considerable variability there. No, they're not actually, because what we did, I imagine that would be true, but what we did was we only reconstructed nodes that appeared 95% or more of the time in our final sample. Now, there's a problem that you reach here, which is that imagine this node came up 20% of the time in our sample. If I reconstructed the ancestral state for that node and I said, oh, I'm certain that it's lichen forming, but that node only came up 20% of the time. Not really sure what I've said. Not much. And so there is this problem that when the node doesn't exist, you can't test the hypothesis. So you have to have a way of saying what is a reasonable node. And again, that's just a kind of, just a guess, an ad hoc sort of guess. Is this a good place to take a break? Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's see, we've got as far as sort of seeing our results, and just to make sure, because some of the questions, it's hard to get your head straight about this, and I'm probably not saying it clearly. Bear in mind that all of these nodes now that are in these panels here, so 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, all of those nodes, they're very, very solid nodes on the tree. They came up in 95% or more of the trees. So the node itself is not in question, but the key thing is that when we find the ancestral state, lichen forming or not, sometimes it's highly variable, and other times it's not. So that just bear in mind that even phylogenetic certainty doesn't necessarily tell you that you can be certain about the ancestral state. David?
Well, I mean, you try to partition that at all, and that there's you've got uncertainty. A, due to your model evolution of the thing you're interested in, the association, and you get, to the extent you see that uncertainty, even if you took a maximum length of the tree, for example, then there's also the uncertainty due to the branch length, and there's an uncertainty due to the topology. Have you tried to separate those out at all?
I haven't. Yeah, it's a good point, though. Yeah.
I think one gets impressed by the fact that every node appears in 95% of the sample. But it's a sample that was taken at the tail of the algorithm's processing, at which you've gone to a local business. And it seems to me that the great deal of what you might otherwise have is false confidence because it's is a consequence of the processing when you are looking only in a very restricted region for alternatives.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And Walter's point is that if you all heard it. I mean, just that when we got to this converged part there, that I was only doing minor modifications. Now, that's a very good point. So we may be stuck. I've shown you one here. I mean, we did this, I don't know. I mean, I say we did it 10 or 20 times. We did it sort of countless times. But the fact is that we were reasonably certain that no matter where we started in the universe, we always ended up here. So that even though once I got here I was doing local modifications, we're reasonably certain, but we can't rule it out, that the universe is pretty well behaved and goes up like this, and that we were in that good place. But I can't rule out for sure that there's another place in the universe with similar likelihoods, but with very different topologies. I can't rule that out.
What happens is after reaching that stage and
running for a while, then you have, you give it a major operation, cut a big branch.
Yeah, I'll show you. That's what I'll get onto now in the sort of second part, because MC cubed, it turns out, is very good for that, this very kind of problem. Yep.
The equipment is, which you start inserting in the calculation, it's also known with some uncertainty. So can you try to see if small calculations in Q applications will affect
We're altering Q there and the branch lengths and the topology, according to just a kind of ad hoc schedule. Yeah.
Have you tried any of these techniques? I believe Holton method uses some of these, like running multiple chains simultaneously, and also doing starting with an initial power likelihood space and then slowly converging down to the...
Yeah, that's what MC cubed is. I'm getting on to that. Yep. Yep. Thank you, David. That was a very good segue. Just to sort of show you the kinds of things. So I said when I reconstructed the ancestral state of lichen-forming or not, I did it with a continuous-time Markov model that just flips between two states, 0 and 1. And it's just sort of showing, this is a very applied slide, that if I fit to the single tree gains of lichenization and losses, I come up with the fact that losses happen with greater rapidity than gains. And this was one of the hypotheses we wanted to test, but the 95% confidence intervals overlap. But when I do the same thing to the MCMC sample, these are the standard deviations. And of course, I have a very big sample. This is 20,000 trees now. So that these, in fact, are highly significantly different now. Whereas fitting the model to a single tree, I couldn't reject the hypothesis. These things look as if they are roughly equal because they're 95% confidence intervals over that. But here I can. So you just get a lot of statistical power in doing this. Now, I think an interesting question, let's not spend a whole lot of time on it because let's get on to the MC cubed business, but let me just back up. I think an interesting question is that when you draw this sample here off the end of the Markov chain, and say you take every 100th tree or every 1,000th tree, they are autocorrelated. And you can see the autocorrelation here. I mean, the chain tends to wander up and down, you know, almost in a sinusoidal way. So that successive trees are correlated in their likelihoods. And so I suppose one question one can ask is, can you treat this as a sample of independent observations from the universe? Do you really have an N here of 10 or 20,000? And so here I have 10,000 trees, and then for these things I was using a sample of 20,000 trees. Do I really have an N of 20,000? And I think the answer is that you do, even though they are autocorrelated. It's a first order autocorrelation in the sense that if you took the difference between successive trees and their likelihood, those differences are uncorrelated. You're moving a random amount. And also the order in which you get these trees off the end of the chain is arbitrary. You could get your sample and then randomize the order and there'd be no autocorrelation. So I think one can treat these as an independent set, and so that you can get this pretty large if you wish, and you can get very, very, very tight estimates of parameters.
So yeah. In the 0.05 to the 4.5, how is that made?
Oh, okay, so what I do is I fit this model and then I vary the value of the parameter in a two log unit radius, the usual two log unit radius.
So in other words, what you do is you have an estimate for the probability of lichenization and delichenization.
Yeah.
And you do that. It would seem that you would have to do the same thing on the right-hand side as well. Or either do that or do Monte Carlo sampling over the lichenization and delichenization rate as well.
Hmm. Yeah, you mean put the lichenization, delichenization into the MCMC model? Yeah, I'm doing that. I'm working on that. I kept it out because I didn't want to bias the sample of trees I came up with. But I'm working on that.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm wondering,
And I think, in fact, it's not going to bias it much because it's one character out of 1,000. But I deliberately kept it out in these cases.
Or to do something where trees that you generate, and afterwards use those posteriors and do a sampling then with the MCMC on lichenization rate.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering whether those error bars are artificially small.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about that. I think they're all right, but...
Can you show the escalation thing if you can?
Yes. Yeah.
It looks pretty much like the white noise, because the amplitudes of high-frequency oscillations is about the same as low-frequency oscillations. And therefore, if it is a white noise, you shouldn't think of correlation.
Good, yeah. That's a nice... way of putting it, yeah. Well, in addition to that sort of thing, I mean, you can get a really nice density distribution. So I calculated the rate of gain of lichenization and the rate of loss for that previous slide. Here was the mean and the standard deviation. But you can also see what the density is, the joint density, and that's quite pretty. And here, this is the one-to-one line. And so you're simply asking how many of the trees does the rate of loss exceed the rate of gain, and it's a very, very high proportion. And you know, rates of loss are highest when rates of gain are lowest, and so on. So you can see the density of the parameter that you're interested in. Again, that's just an applied thing. It's quite nice to be able to see that. So we've talked about a lot of these MCMC sum issues, lack of convergence. What would you do about that? We'll get on to that in a minute. I'll move to MC cubed. We didn't have any problems with lack of convergence in the examples I gave you, but I'll talk about that in a moment. But these things, tree and parameter proposal mechanisms, I probably haven't given you very satisfactory answers, because it's really just done in a very ad hoc way at the moment. Parameter proposal mechanisms being taken from symmetrical distributions because they're easy to deal with. Tree proposal mechanisms just sort of ad hoc, shifting things around a lot or not very much. And I think these are all, I think, very important issues for research in MCMC. Tree and parameter updating schedules. And you know, you here you're on a tree, you propose a new tree, and you go there. So what you've done is you've taken a new topology, but you've kept the parameters in the Q matrix. Well, now what do? Do you propose another tree, or do you propose a new set of parameters in the Q matrix? What's the schedule that you use? So do you do the same thing n times in a row, and then move on to that one and do it n times in a row, where n is just some number you choose out of the air? Or do you flip back and forth between the two? And these are all issues, I mean, sort of computer science issues of what gives you the best convergence and what gives you the best coverage of the universe. At the moment, we seem to find that if you do the same thing four or five times in a row, like propose new trees, leaving the parameters unchanged, and then propose new parameters, leaving the trees unchanged, that sort of works. But again, it's all very ad hoc. And then finally, detecting convergence, you know, at one level, it's a sort of prosaic question. How do you know when you've converged? You know, the thing goes up and then it gets flat. But how do you know that if you just, you know, didn't wait to hear, it would jump up again? And so this is a problem, how long to run the chain. Okay, and those are all things we can talk and argue about. I won't have very good answers to them, but I think those are important issues for MCMC at the moment. Okay, some of these questions, though, can be answered with another technique, which is MC cubed, Metropolis coupled Markov chain Monte Carlo. And it's really very simple, despite the fact that it has this sort of terrible name, which is that with Metropolis-coupled Markov chain Monte Carlo, everything from here on over is the same as I've been talking about, but we just run a number of chains, M chains, simultaneously, and we swap among chains, among a randomly chosen pair, I and J, each iteration according to. And we just use the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm again to decide whether if we take the states of this chain and swap it into that one, we get a new tree, so XJ goes to YJ, having taken some of the parameters of XI and and xi goes to yi, having taken some of the parameters of xj, and we come up with these new trees. So yi we can compare to xi. So basically we say we'll accept it with probability equal to the product of the likelihood ratios of chain I times chain j. We've got two events. We want the product of their probabilities now. And so we'll accept a swap between chains following the Metropolis Hastings algorithm applied to the chain. So that's why it's Metropolis coupled Markov chain Monte Carlo. Now, the idea of MC cubed is that if something in this chain, if this chain has got stuck, for example, in some local state, it could be that this is basically like sort of recombination or sex in biology, that you can get some information from another chain that will get you out of that region. So MC cubed is thought to be a way of getting chains out of stuck situations. Now, David?
Is it necessarily a reciprocal combination? If you just swap in parameters from one chain into the other, can you make the movement one at a time? Or do you have to swap them back and forth?
Yeah, well, yeah, we're swapping. Yeah, this algorithm is making a swap symmetrically. It's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. And it's one of the things I want to talk about with MC cubed, is that there's a lot of, I think, really important questions that need to be tackled sort of analytically at a very deep statistical level. I don't know the answer to that. But now what we do with MC is that we designate one of our chains to be the cold chain. So this one now will have the nice Markov properties. And we're applying the Metropolis Hastings tree acceptance algorithm to that. But then we have these heated chains, and we hope these heated chains will explore the universe very, very well. So they'll be gathering information about the universe that this one might not. And then we can swap information from those into the cold chain, and it's only the cold chain that is used for inference, because it is thought to have the properties of the Markov chain, whereas these ones you can see are going to visit states not in proportion to their probability of occurrence, but these heated chains are going to visit states according to their probability of occurrence raised to some power. You know, it's going to flatten the landscape. Yeah. Well, here again, we could say that this chain and this chain, they have a topology, they have a set of branch lengths, and they have a Q matrix. So one of the things we might do is say, okay, let's take the Q matrix from here, stick it into here, so we'll swap the Q matrices. Okay? Or we could take the topology and branch lengths, because they only make sense if they go together, take the topology and branch lengths here and put it on that Q matrix and see if we get a better result. So. Well, it's large scale only in the sense that just think of it as either taking the Q matrix out here and putting it in there, or taking the tree and branch lengths here and putting it in there. So it's not actually changing the tree, it's just swapping whatever there is between two chains. The tree itself hasn't been altered. Yeah.
If it is symmetric, then why would the cold tree remain cold?
Yeah, we always calculate its likelihood and put it into the Metropolis Hastings tree acceptance algorithm in a cold state.
So what is playing the role of temperature in this model? Any one temperature?
I'll show you. Literally just raising the likelihood to a power. Right here. I think that's the next slide. We can come back to this. So just quite literally, I mean, this isn't very important. These are just ways, you know, here's the temperatures. We could say that the temperature is 1 upon I. I is the number of chains, or use this. And so if I have four chains, and I'm using the 1 upon I, you know, I've got one chain at that temperature, see, one chain at that, one chain at that, and then the cold chain raised to the 1th power. So it's let's back up. So I'm going along with my Markov chain, and I try to swap between two.
Right. So in the cold chain, you have to relax after a swap.
Then in the cold chain, I do this. I.
And before you start picking samples with the acid again in the cold chain.
Before I start taking samples, you mean if I'm sampling off the end of the converged chain?
Yeah, you're sampling from the cold chain, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do. No, I do it right after I've done a swap, and I'll show you one of the things that can lead to. Yeah, so I swap according to. Yeah. No, I mean, good point. I mean, let me show you. You're exactly right. I mean, it can lead to some nasty behavior. But very good point.
Is there a theoretical justification? I mean, I think there's sort of the Metropolis that there is a theoretical justification for that. Is there a theoretical justification for this type of operation?
To be honest, I mean, there is. Gibbs has worked a lot on this. Geyer has worked a lot on this. I can't give it to you off the top of my head, but so long as one swaps according to this acceptance mechanism and you keep this chain cold, then this chain retains its equilibrium properties for inference.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if I go down that direction, I'm doing my usual altering trees and things. But in a swap, I'm just taking whatever I have here and trying to fit it on there, and whatever I have here and trying to fit it on there. Well, yeah, so imagine I've got a tree and its branch lengths and a queue. Maybe I'll take, and I've got a tree and branch lengths and queue. I'll take this tree with its branch lengths and say, I'll fit it onto that queue. How well does it work? So if this chain had found a tree with branch lengths that was some good part of the universe, maybe Walter, you know, you were wondering about going to all these parts of the universe, and it was really a good one that this one hadn't found, then I would get that information into my cold chain. Yeah, it's one of the issues I'll get to at the end. I mean, if you run a single chain and you heat it up, it's probably going to do very good things, and it's eventually going to get to some equilibrium. Now, once you get to the equilibrium, though, I think you have to cool it down, because if you don't cool it down, it won't have the equilibrium properties of the Markov chain. It'll be hopping around too much.
Actually, you don't need to.
Okay.
All you need to do is to, when you do the averages, weight it by the log of the likelihood, or the ratio of the likelihoods. So in simulated annealing, you could do your sampling at one temperature and then calculate your distribution giving another temperature. That's just a...
Weighting by the temperature somehow.
You weight by the likelihood values.
Yeah, no, that's one of the issues I wanted to raise. I mean, you're answering. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, let me just show you what. Let's see. So that's just some temperature. Here's what should happen. So what? This is the fungi data again, and now this is easy to get confused about. There's four different runs here. This run was a run of a single chain. The yellow one is a run of three chains, where one of them's cold, two of them are heated. The pinkish one is two chains, and this one is four chains. Now, one of the things you should see immediately is that MC cubed is hugely expensive computationally, because here, in this case, four chains, I'm doing four times as much work. I've got four chains going. I'm doing all the likelihood calculations four times, blah, 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 blah. And so the idea is it should converge more quickly to give you back something or it should go to places that the single chain doesn't go to give you back something for all that effort. And even though this looks like it's working and that the one chain is slow, 2 and 3 and 4, so 4 being the fastest, really, and I think this is important, what's happening, if you see when they're converging, they're all actually converging at about the same number of generations. And so it's not really clear that the MC cubed has got you very much here. That, so this isn't converged, you know, they're converging, you know, right in here somewhere. Who knows? I mean, maybe they're converging out here. But then this guy is coming along, and he classically looks pretty stuck. And then all of a sudden, he pops up there. Yeah, these may not even be in the same region. Yeah, I mean, I think they are in this particular case, but they may not be in the same region. Now, this is the sort of thing that you hope MC cubed is good for, and that it looks as if this guy's stuck. He's clearly not as good as these guys. And all of a sudden, he just goes pretty much straight up. And indeed, this was a two-chain run. You know, he did swap over with his other chain there, and he happened to get some information, and that allowed him to come up here. But in the end, it isn't clear to me here that the MC cubed would have been any better than, say, running this single cold chain 4 times, which would have been just as much effort as running this one once. Because they got up there about the same place. Now, I haven't done thousands of these, and I can't tell you statistically how many times, you know, this one works better and so on, but having played around with it just a little bit, my feeling is that MC cubed, if you've got a decent algorithm that's, you know, getting you up there, not getting you stuck, MC cubed isn't really repaying all of the effort over perhaps just running a whole lot of single chains and seeing if they converge to the same place. Although, as I say, there's some evidence here that, you know, it's helping out. So that's comparing 4 different runs. We can have a look here. There's another point I want to make about MC cubed. Let's have a look now at 2 of the chains. So here's now a 2-chain MC cubed run. So here's the cold chain, and here's the heated chain. And the point I want to make about this is down here are swapping events. Here are swapping events. And if you look here, you can see that right at the very beginning there was a swap. But then from here, right the way to here, all of this region in here, there was no swapping going on. Now remember, swapping goes according to the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. 1, if the swap is better, or the product of the probabilities if the swap is worse. And the thing to bear in mind is that if you look at these 2 chains, the cold chain going like this, this chain going like here, they, you know, here they're differing by what, like 800 log units or something like that. So the probability that a swap is going to lead to anything any good is very, very low. So MC cubed will typically not give you swaps, perhaps, you know, where you really want it. If you look like you're stuck here, maybe you want some new information coming in, you're not going to get swaps in there. But in fact, once you get out here to where they've converged and everybody has more or less the same tree, the same queues, the same branch lengths, they start swapping like mad. And I think this will be a very general property of MC cubed, is that perhaps where you want it the most, and I'm not actually saying you want it the most here, but perhaps where you want it, you're not going to be getting the swapping. Now, this is a really interesting case here, because the 2 chains, this guy looks like he's stuck here, and then he just goes zooming up, and you think, oh, good, he swapped with the green chain there. But in fact, it didn't. They crossed each other, their likelihoods crossed, but it's a stochastic thing, whether you swap or not. And when they crossed, they didn't happen to swap. And so this chain just happened to find something new on its own and climb up. So that's something I think bears thinking about a bit more. Is it, does MC cubed really repay the computational effort? And now let me bearing that in mind, let me introduce a new problem and show you 2 similar slides about it. I'm doing some work on a group of retrotransposable elements that infect your genomes called line elements. And these are elements that live in your genome, live in the genomes of mammals, and they have the retrotransposons. They have the capability of sitting in your genome, lifting themselves out, leaving the original behind, making a copy, traveling along, and falling back somewhere else in the genome, cutting themselves back into the DNA. So it's like having a raging infection within your genome. And all of you have this infection, and all of you have somewhere around 500,000 of these retrotransposons in your genome as we speak. And about 30 or 40 or 50 of them are active, and they are making copies of themselves in your genome, in your somatic cells, and they occasionally do nasty things, like cause nasty diseases. So they're of interest to evolutionary biologists to understand their evolution and spread within our genome. How did they spread? So we collected data on, here are 100 elements. 4KB sequence defines, well, it's a 6KB sequence, but we have 4KB, 4,000 bases that we've aligned. And we've made, so these are all line elements that we have pulled out of the human genome. And the lovely thing about them is that they trace the history of mammalian evolution. So all of these ones that are not in red, the black ones, these are all human line elements. Here's a line element that we got out of a gorilla. Here's a line element that we got out of a mouse, and it goes deeper into the phylogeny. And here's a line element that we got out of a possum, and it goes, as it should, right down to the bottom. So it's just tracing the evolution of mammals. First, the split between marsupials and placentals, and then the diversification of the orders of mammals, and so on, leading up to the present, where we come into these ones that are very similar to the ones in gorillas. Okay, that's just why we're interested in this. But one of the things that we'll want to do with this phylogeny is say, well, look how it breaks into these clades. And it turns out, I haven't told you, that every single one of these elements on this tree, they're all extinct, save for a couple right here. So extinct in the sense that the line element has actually lost the ability to retrotranspose in your genome. So I said you had 500,000 relics of these things in your genome, but only about 20 to 50 of them are active. And it turns out that all of the active ones are highly, highly, highly closely related to each other phylogenetically. So it looks as if there has been this winnowing process right from the very beginning, that there was a sort of lineage, you'll like this, Walter, it reminds me of your flu stuff, there's a lineage that's going to make it to the present. We didn't know what it was prospectively, but there's just one lineage that's going to make it to the present, but all these other lineages go extinct. And so it's interesting to ask, at each one of these major branching points, is there something that differs between the ones on the left that are going to go extinct and the ones on the right, one of which is going to make it to the present? And so we want to be able to reconstruct these nodes with some confidence. Hence, MCMC.
These are
sort of the perfect phylogenetic character, because given that they've been extinct for so long, they're just attracting substitutions, just background substitutions. So this is all neutral evolution here. So they line up rather nicely, as if there's a molecular clock. That's why I've been so outrageous as to actually put a time on here.
Just, and they're all extinct except some down here by the gorilla.
Yeah. It's a lot like your flu. Yeah, well, molecular evolution is slow. I mean, you've got 6,000 bases that have a signature. They 6,000 bases, yeah, and they've got two introns in them. Two open reading frames. And so they retain a signal. Beyond possum, they really start to lose their signal. But we think we can go back about maybe 150 million years with them. Yeah.
So in terms of the extinction process, they get copied in, and I could imagine that the copying in would deactivate it, and that it wouldn't be active anymore, or that it could be active and then gradually lose the ability.
Yeah. Both happen. Yeah.
Normally, like human.
Pardon me? Oh, so these are all of these, save for possum, mouse, and gorilla, are found in the human genome. And we just use these to sort of calibrate the tree.
So there's presumably also a big spread in the possum elements and the mouse elements.
Yeah, they're quite different from each other. Oh, well, yeah, indeed. They've probably got 500,000. They've probably got 500,000.
Yeah, so each one of these, they've got the tree by themselves.
Yeah.
So how do you...
Well, we were just interested in looking at the ones in humans, how we got up to these
the...
Yeah. Humans. Yeah, these are the human ones.
And the ones in the red mouse, is that a typical one rather than mouse?
Don't know. I mean, there's been so few that have been found. Now, this is one of the benefits of the Human Genome Project, because now that we've got the human genome... Yeah, now we've got the mouse. That's right. If we ring up Craig.
If you took a different mouse one, they roll for the pawn.
I hope so, yeah. I hope so. Yeah, that's what I'm implying.
Well, all the human ones are paralogs. You're not asking which human is the mouse or phallus, because it's just an outgroup with respect to the rest.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to understand the substitution model that would be appropriate for this. So obviously if it's dead, then it's just substituting naturally. On the other hand, if you're looking at the regions prior to death, then there is selective pressure of the...
Well, there may be. We don't know.
But in other words, so it may be the idea of using a single substitution matrix for this may be inappropriate.
Well, it could be, yeah. I've been fitting... If I fit... it's quite fun because these things are dead, and they should fit a transition transversion model. And they do. They fit a transition transversion model far better than whoever... I never can remember the single parameter model, whoever it was who dreamt that up.
Jukes and Cantor,
yeah, I never remember. It was two. Okay, so the Chimera, God rest his soul, fits better than Jukes and Cantor.
Wen-Chung Li, I think, and somebody developed a formula for making the same proper assumptions that when they went extinct, and because you see different rates. When they're not extinct from what they are extinct, and you've got a sample size of at least three, I think it's already fine. You can calculate when using the clock.
Yeah. I was wondering about that, sort of a heterogeneous model for this, in which case you could do this what you say, it's okay. But I'm thinking in terms of the extinct, the selective pressure is sort of bizarre in this, in that if the organism doesn't care whether it's reproducing or capable of reproducing or not. So it's almost like you're looking at a substitution model that would only be relevant if you actually had a duplication problem.
It isn't necessarily the host that you have. It can be the retroposon itself has its own destiny that's trying to fulfill.
Uh-huh.
And so it can... Well, that means that mutations which affect its ability to transpose or what kills it or not.
The thing about this, though, is that if you have normal evolution with selective pressure, you die if you don't reproduce and you only get the progeny. But here you're sequencing both the progeny and the original. And the original is there whether or not it has a lethal mutation. So in terms of a model for the evolution, it is a little bit bizarre.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, my bias is that, yeah, there certainly is, and there's been just stacks of selection going on. But one can't rule out a kind of Medawarian test tube model that you just go forward in time, and if you have bad luck, a coconut falls on your head, you're dead. It has nothing to do with your fitness. If it doesn't, you're alive. And that's one of the questions we want to answer with this. And so, you know, I'm going to want to reconstruct ancestral states. I'm going to want to... So I've got to know... Gosh, well, that may be the end of that. Let's see if we can carry on. Now let's see, had enough of that tree. Let's now, so I, you know, I've been fooling around with these data. What did I do here? So here again, this is this MC cubed business. So I ran an analysis with four chains, that's the red, and I ran an analysis with one chain, and same kind of story as we had a couple of slides ago, that you know, these may be just well-behaved data so that the algorithm goes right up and then, okay, let's say it's converged here, not really sure, but this is four times as much work, and actually, you know, it reached convergence after the one chain. And what's the reason? Well, you know, you can guess. The reason is this swapping business. Here was a run with three chains. So the cold chain, hot chain, and warm chain, the intermediate. And you can see the big likelihood differences here. So swapping is just extremely unlikely. And sure enough, the first swap wasn't till here, and it was a swap between two of the heated chains. It wasn't a swap with the cold chain. So none of the information that you want to be maybe getting into the cold chain is getting there. And then you wait a long time, and all of a sudden, these two guys start exchanging information like mad. And it's not until you get here that you get a swap between the warm chain and the cold chain. But there again, they're both more or less in the same place. So here again is this sort of, I think, inherent problem with MC cubed, as much as I like it, that we're not really getting swapping until we probably don't need it very much. Now, let's back up and say, well, had it been the case that this cold chain had gone up like this and had to cross through this kind of asteroid belt, you know, had to cross through these other chains, it's quite likely maybe that one of these chains would have given it some information. So it could be that we're getting a bad picture of MC cubed here because this is a fairly well-behaved surface. I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, I quite agree with this, and I think this is where some work has to be done, is that one leaves this one alone because, or leaves it cold so that it has all the nice properties. But my feeling is, and Richard, you were talking about this a little bit, that, you know, maybe if we allowed easier swapping, but somehow we retain that information here, we know what we did, we can get the properties we want out of this cold chain when it does converge. But the point that was raised about when you swap, you lose equilibrium is true. I mean, if you look at the next slide, look here. So right here, there was a swap between this, which one was that? The warm chain and the cold chain. And look what the cold chain does. It drops. And as a matter of fact, if you plot the trees that you get, so here were the pre-swap trees, and here were the post-swap trees. So you actually moved the cold chain to a worse part of the universe with the swapping. Now, I was running this, so the issue is, well, now if you let this thing go on and on out here and here, would this cold chain come back to where it was? And I think it was my three-year-old, he decided he didn't want my computer running any longer, so he stopped it. They have a way of doing that. And this took about 3 or 4 days to get, and as I say, I'm just terribly sort of unorganized about these things, and so I never got around to seeing what this chain would have done had we let it go. But indeed, the point about you drop yourself right out of equilibrium, if this one was at equilibrium, you pull yourself right out, and what to do about that is a very important one, I think. Yeah.
What about just a simple conventional genetic algorithm, in the idea that with a genetic algorithm you would end up having a bunch of things of solutions that were more or less at equilibrium with each other, so there wouldn't be these gigantic likelihood differences one member of the population.
Yeah, and that's probably a good suggestion. I think computationally it might be pretty nasty, but
Well, it's the same thing. You just have constant temperature rather than.
Yeah. Yeah. David?
You take into account relative heating of the machine, you can guarantee yourself that it will stay in equilibrium. I mean, it's possible to arrange things that you guarantee, for example, off the posterior of any particular parameter that you swap, and as long as there's sampling off that posterior, you should stay in equilibrium.
Where? Here? Or?
Yeah.
That here? Right after the swap, you think you are staying in equilibrium?
Well, I don't know exactly how to change, but you can.
Yeah.
You will guarantee yourself you're staying in equilibrium.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know about stay, but return to. I mean, let's imagine we were in equilibrium here. Now, we may not have been. But this thing has got worse. Now, I'm quite confident that if you let it go, it's going to hop back up. But I suppose the question is, at some point, do you have to stop swapping and just let the cold chain go? I don't know. I haven't thought very hard about it. Yeah, Walter.
Are you in all the chains at different temperatures? Are you localizing the chains for the
This was all pretty disruptive stuff. I think here I was still using a pretty beefy tree proposal mechanism, so the acceptance rates were very, very low. It's one of the reasons it takes so long. But, yeah. Maybe I should just go on to the final slide, because it's just sort of listing. Oh, just to show you, I mean, when we did all this, it's quite nice. We can find these nodes having quite high probability. That's just getting back to the applied question. We can actually say that these nodes are very real.
If these genes are dead, how do you know they? How do you know they are previously were active in the present genome?
Yeah, I mean, they could get there by chromosomal duplication,
no,
something
just
like that. Oh, well, yeah. I'll bet there are many more than that. Those are the 500,000 that we can detect using typical
with
some scheme of aligning. Yeah. There's probably many, many more. These things are, yeah, that's a whole other. But here's just some topics and issues. I mean, we can go back to these. We talked about most of these, but MCMC, you know, highly inefficient tree swapping and curlage. Early tree swapping, once converged, cool the heated chains and use an inference. I mean, there's just lots and lots of things we could do, lots of questions that come up about the various, you know, and we've already talked about most of these. I think that's all I have to say.
Given the lateness of the hour, why don't we stop here and then just continue as a discussion session in the founder's group?